She knew better than that. The only aid you gave in a gunfight was putting rounds on the enemy. Two shots rang out, both in rapid succession. They were followed by two more. She had no idea how many attackers were in the alley, but she did know that someone was using a suppressor and someone wasn't. With her weapon up and ready, she was about to snatch a quick peek around the edge of the dumpster when she heard McGee's voice. "Tango's down. I'm coming to you. Don't shoot. Be ready to move, copy?" "Affirmative," Ryan replied. Her weapon was in tight, close to her chest, but ready to be fired. McGee approached soundlessly, and then scuffed the ground with his shoes the last couple of feet so she would know where he was. He nudged Florentino with his foot to see if he would move. He didn't. He was probably dead. Stepping around the dumpster, he held his free hand out to Ryan and helped her up.
"Is he dead?"
she asked, looking down at her former teammate. McGee nodded. "I think so." Ryan bent over and felt for his pulse as she surveyed the scene.
"What the hell happened?"
"At least three shooters," McGee replied, pointing with his 1911 to the bodies on the ground. The baying of police klaxons could be heard only a few blocks away. "We need to get going."
"Go through their pockets," she told him, jerking her head toward the shooters. "I'll do Florentino."
"Waste of time. We need to get moving."
"Bob, please," said Ryan.
Shaking his head, McGee disengaged and moved quickly over to the three dead men. By the time he was done patting them down, Ryan had joined him. She had Florentino's iPhone. "That's not coming with us," the former Delta Force operator said as he pointed at the phone. "They can track us with it." She knew he was right.
"I just want to see what he has on it, and then we'll toss it."
"Fine. Right now, let's just get the hell out of here." Ryan nodded and followed McGee as he headed quickly down the alley. Just before they emerged at the sidewalk, he stopped and listened.
"Damn it," he said.
"What is it?" "The police are getting close. We're going to have to go the long way around to get the car." They had debated whether to park far from the bar or to park closer. Ryan had wanted to be closer, in case they needed to get out of there fast. McGee had wanted to be farther away, for exactly that same reason. There were good arguments to be made for both, and in the end, they had split the difference. They moved perpendicular to the sound of the approaching police cars and made sure not to be seen. As keyed up as police officers would be racing to a shooting, they were still taught to keep their eyes open and look for any potential suspects leaving the scene of a crime. While Ryan doubted the cops had anything more to go on than the address and shots fired in the alley, she didn't want to risk getting rolled up. The only way they were going to get to the bottom of what was going on was to stay as many steps ahead of Phil Durkin as possible. They couldn't do that if they were sitting in jail. They also couldn't do that if they were dead. Even though Ryan had a bunch of questions she wanted to ask, she kept quiet. It wasn't only the police they had to watch out for. There could be more shooters looking for them right now. Both she and McGee needed to move quickly and quietly. As they neared the car, Ryan removed Florentino's iPhone and rapidly scrolled through his texts, emails, and browsing history. "Anything?" McGee asked.
"Personal stuff, but nothing we can really use," she replied, as she stepped over to a storm drain and tossed it in.
"For what it's worth, the stiffs in the alley were clean too. No ID, no pocket litter, nothing."
"More pros."
McGee nodded. A block away, they could hear another police car, and they both climbed quickly into the Mustang. Once they had put enough distance between them and the scene, Ryan asked,
"How the hell did they find us?"
"I think maybe we found them."
"Meaning there was a team on Florentino?"
McGee nodded and made another turn in order to see if anyone was following them. "I'll bet they have teams on all of them."
"But why kill Florentino?"
"I don't think they meant to kill him. I think they meant to kill you." Ryan was quiet for a moment as that sank in. "They nailed him in the upper chest and base of his throat," McGee continued, "right where
my head would have been had I not dropped," she said, finishing his sentence for him.
"With that kind of luck, we ought to stop off and have you buy a lottery ticket."
"It wasn't luck," she replied pensively. "It was instinct. Florentino knew they were there. His eyes gave them away. For some reason, something inside me just told me to react."
"Call it whatever you want, but you were smart to listen to it. Between you and that Florentino guy, I'm glad it was him. and not you that bought it.
Ryan didn't respond. McGee accelerated to make it through the light that was changing up ahead. Once he had cleared the intersection, he asked,
"Do you think he knew what they were intending to do to you?"
Ryan shook her head.
"No. We were friends once. If he knew, I think he would have found a way to warn me."
"Maybe he did."
She fell silent again, and McGee didn't push the conversation. After several minutes, Ryan said,
"I'm glad you followed me outside. Thank you."
"You would have been fine," he replied. "You've got great instincts."
"No, you were right. I got lucky. Very lucky."
"Don't start second-guessing everything now and overanalyzing it. It's done."
Changing the subject, he asked,
"Did you recognize who was shooting at us?"
"No, I've never seen them before."
"I don't know what kind of pies Durkin has his dirty little fingers into, but he has access to a lot of manpower. Two hitters at my place, two at yours, and now two more on Florentino."
"If you're right," said Ryan, "and he's got people watching the other team members, we're not going to be able to get close to them, much less get them to talk to us."
"There is still one way," McGee reminded her.
"Bob, I told you no. No children."
"That was when they'd only used a taser on you. I thought being shot at might change your mind."
"It hasn't. We'll have to come up with another way."
"Well, the McGee Idea Factory is closed for renovations. You're going to have to come up with something on your own."
Ryan turned in her seat to face him.
"Are you telling me you won't help?"
"I'm telling you that you got my best idea. Hell, you got my only idea. I'm fresh out. That's it."
She didn't believe him.
"We just need to think harder."
"If I try to think this thing through any harder, there's going to be smoke coming out of my ears. Listen, you know me. I'm a simple guy. I made a career out of tracking down bad guys, kicking in their doors, and shooting them in the head. Sometimes, I delayed that last part long enough to have a chat with them, but not often. I'm not a schemer. I don't construct intricate plots and ruses. I'm a door kicker. It's in my blood, and I'm not ashamed of that. As far as I'm concerned, the shortest distance between two points really is a straight line. Often, the simplest answer is the best."
"Wait," she interjected. "Say that again."
"What? About the simplest answer being the best?"
"No, the other part."
McGee took his eyes off the road and looked at her.
"About the shortest distance between two points being a straight line?"
"That's it,"
Ryan admitted with a look of satisfaction.
"What's it?"
"It's something Tom Cushing, our team leader, always said. The shortest distance between two points isn't a straight line. It's an angle."
"Meaning?"
"Meaning," said Ryan, as she opened the Mustang's glove box to see if it had a map, "I think I know how we're going to beat Phil Durkin at his own game."
Chapter 41. Boston, Massachusetts. She had lied to him. She had told him her name was Chloe. He knew it wasn't, but it didn't matter. Prostitutes lied. Drug addicts lied. Runaways lied. They all lied. He had lied, too. When her instincts kicked in and the fear began to consume her, he told her he wasn't going to hurt her. She knew he was lying, but at that point, there was nothing she could do about it except die. The doctors had lied, too. They had told him that as long as he continued diligently with the medication, he would be able to keep things under control. And by things, they meant his urges, his impulses, that primal part of himself that delighted in power and the taking of life. He saw himself as a lion on the savannah, free to eat whatever he wanted whenever he was hungry. Of course, that's what the meds were for. They were supposed to curb his appetite. It didn't mean he'd stopped killing, though. They brought him out from time to time, sent him hither and yon. One of the doctors asked him once if he expected any explanation as to why he was asked to kill. It was a very frank session, but then again, it was a very frank subject. Nevertheless, he merely shrugged in response. He didn't need an explanation or a justification. It was all about balance. Without some form of equilibrium, all living things on the savannah, even the lion, would perish from the earth. Taking a kudu or a water buffalo, or even a giraffe or elephant from time to time,
was simply nature's way of maintaining harmony. He was the lion. It was what lions did. Tonight, the lion was preparing to kill again. It would be dramatic, as befitted his stature. The young woman he had left in the Charles was because he had been hungry. When a lion is hungry, it eats. This is the way of the world. This was the way of his world. For the moment, he was satiated. Having cleansed himself of his need, he could focus on the task at hand. Another key, another garage, another vehicle, another neighborhood. Everything was waiting for him, just as before. Locking the garage door behind him, he removed his flashlight and surveyed the van. Upon it was the name of a plumbing company. It had a Boston address and a Boston telephone number as well. It wouldn't strike anyone as unusual that such a vehicle might be out at night conducting a plumbing repair. Plumbing problems happened, and they happened at all hours. Sliding open the cargo area door, he found coveralls with the name Mickey embroidered on the left chest and the company name on the back, worn work boots, a tool belt, a pillow, and a clipboard loaded with invoices and the other accumulated receipts and pieces of paper a person of his assumed identity would amass in the course of doing his job. There were lengths of copper and PVC pipe, blowtorches, cylindrical tanks, a padded moving blanket, various pieces of plumbing equipment including grates, drain snakes, and rods of all sizes, heavy metal buckets with lids, plungers, spare parts, multiple service manuals, old plumbing catalogs, a few cinder blocks, and a small stack of bricks that looked like they might have been reclaimed from a job site. The monotony of it all would bore even the most inquisitive of police officers. For his part, though, he had no intention of dealing with law enforcement. They merely appeared after the fact to admire the lion's work. In the back of the van was a large metal gang box on casters, used for organizing and locking up tools or other pieces of equipment. Removing another key from his pocket, he placed his flashlight between his teeth and stepped into the van. He walked back to the gang box and tapped its lid with the key. He knew there was a little mouse inside, but the mouse was being very quiet. He tapped again, and then again once more. Fear radiated out from the box like steam from a pile of hot rocks doused with water in a sauna. He felt a chill run through his body. Getting a purchase on the gang box, he shook it violently and then pounded the lid near one of the air holes with his fist. He pressed his ear up against the side and strained to listen. Was the little mouse cowering? He certainly hoped so. A mouse should cower in the presence of a lion. He rested on his haunches for a full 5 minutes without moving. Then, without warning, he lashed out and gave the appliance a kick. He enjoyed torturing his victim this way. It made him feel powerful and in control, which, of course, he was. Looking at his watch, he ran through all of the steps on his agenda for the evening. It was going to be a long night, but he was looking forward to it. Reaching into his backpack, he removed the dinner he had prepared and laid everything out on a piece of newspaper. He turned off his flashlight and allowed himself to be consumed by the darkness. It was not something that frightened him anymore. It had become part of him, and he a part of it. The darkness had been when his grandfather would come for him. The man's enormous gnarled hands trafficked in unspeakable terror. On a shelf overlooking his bed, as those hands did what they did, sat a small plastic lion, watching. It never attacked, never pounced and went for the man's throat, though night after night the boy wordlessly willed it so. No matter how horribly he suffered, or how strenuously he entreated the lion with his eyes, it never moved. It never so much as even twitched. How he had admired the lion. How he had admired its supernatural reserve and its lack of concern for anything but itself. It didn't fear the darkness. It didn't fear the old man and his gnarled hands. It feared nothing, and everything feared it. When he committed his first kill, he had made sure the lion was there to savor the moment with him. He wanted the lion to see that he was no longer afraid. Just as important, He wanted the lion to see that he could strike fear into others. Sitting back in the van, the killer steadied his breathing, slowed his heart rate, and became one with the darkness. From inside the stainless steel box, he caught a fresh scent of fear, heavy with the inevitability of what the night would bring and the certainty that there was nothing and no one who could ever stop the lion. Chapter 42. Cordero had chosen a small Italian restaurant in Boston's North End, not far from the Paul Revere House and the Old North Church. The neighborhood's narrow European-style streets had been washed clean by the rain and might have added to the ambiance if Harvath didn't have so much on his mind. Even Cordero, who had changed into an attractive outfit for dinner, couldn't shake him from the mood he had slipped into. "I heard from Sal," she said after the waiter had set down their drinks and went to take care of another table. "The FBI came up bust on the prince as well." Harvath wasn't surprised, but he still shook his head.
"I feel like we're missing something."
"We're not."
"How can you be so sure?"
"Because this is what I do for a living," Cordero replied. "Building a homicide case is like assembling a watch. It takes time. Every single piece is important and has to be put in the right place. They're very labor-intensive. In fact, you know what one of the most important qualities is for a homicide investigator?"
"Attention to detail?" he asked.
"Patience." Picking up her wine glass, she switched gears. "What did you do before getting into K&R? She had a knack for asking him questions that required careful answers.
"I actually worked for the Secret Service."
"So you were in law enforcement?"
"Not really," he replied. "I did protective work."
"Why the change?"
"There were great people there, but I came to the conclusion that I didn't like being on defense. Too often it felt like I was just sitting around waiting for something to happen."
"Kind of like now."
"Ironic, huh?"
"But that's what's bothering you, isn't it? Without some major breakthrough, there's probably going to be another victim. Maybe even more than one." He nodded. She looked at him.
"It bothers me, too." "So, what do we do about it?"
Cordero took a sip of her wine.
"We hope for a major breakthrough."
"I'd settle for even a minor breakthrough,"
Harvath replied as he picked up his menu.
"Patience is the companion of wisdom."
"I've heard that before."
"Who said that?"
"St. Augustine."
Harvath smiled knowingly.
"What?"
she asked.
"I had a commanding officer a long time ago who liked to quote St. Augustine. His favorite line was, 'No eulogy is due to a man who simply does his duty and nothing more.'"
"Apparently it stuck with you."
Harvath nodded. It was his turn now to switch gears.
"Why did you ask me to dinner?"
"I wanted to get you drunk."
He laughed.
"And then what?"
"And then I'm going to pry every secret I can out of you."
"Well, that's a relief. For a minute there, I was worried you were going to take advantage of me."
"You don't strike me as the kind of person who gets taken advantage of."
"Are you kidding? I'm the softest touch on the planet. Anything having to do with kids or animals?"
"Right,"
she said, interrupting him.
"For your information, I'm not the kind of person who gets taken advantage of either."
"You think I'm kidding?"
he asked, as he pulled his phone from his pocket and unlocked it. Scrolling through some pictures, he found the one he wanted and showed it to her. Cordero's eyes widened.
"What kind of horse is that?"
"That's not a horse," he laughed. "That's my dog."
"What breed?"
"He's a Russian Ovcharka."
"A what?" she asked with a grin, trying to pronounce the name but not doing very well.
"Ovcharka,"
Harvath replied, drawing the word out slowly.
"They're also known as Caucasian sheepdogs. The Russian military and the East German Border Patrol love these dogs. They're very fast, very loyal, and let's just say you wouldn't want to make one angry."
"I'll take your word for it. He's huge. What's his name?"
"Bullet."
"You named your dog Bullet?"
"He's named after a pal of mine whose nickname was Bullet Bob."
"Was?"
"Bob was a counterterrorism operative. He died doing what he loved."
"I'm sorry," she said.
"It's okay."
"How do you keep a dog that big in D.C.?"
"He doesn't live with me. I travel too much."
"Where's he live, then?"
"With an old girlfriend."
You share custody of your dog with an ex?
You really are a soft touch, said Cordero.
Do you have a picture of your son?
I do, she said, reaching into her purse and removing her phone. It was taken at the beach on a beautiful sunny day. He was a handsome little boy with a big smile.
He's very cute, Harvath replied. He looks a lot like you.
The detective smiled.
He actually looks a lot like his father. Do you mind if I ask how he died?
Taking the phone back, she looked at her son's picture for a moment and then placed it in her purse.
No, I don't mind you asking. He drowned. It was at that same stretch of beach in the photo I just showed you. We used to go there every summer with friends. It was the middle of the day. It was hot, sunny. We were all swimming, having a good time. One moment he was there, and the next he was just gone.
Is that why your partner took over the scene at the Charles River this morning? Is that kind of thing hard for you?
Not usually. I guess it depends.
Well, you seemed like you had it together. You were pretty tough on me.
Cordero smiled.
I enjoyed being tough on you.
I could tell. Both of you did.
Sal can be a bit overprotective.
No kidding, replied Harvath.
As far as kicking me loose to go interview those girls with you, I'll fill you in on a little secret. Sal's also a bit of a snob. He's from Southie, you know.
Really?
Yep. Joined the army to escape his old neighborhood. Ended up coming home and becoming a cop. He helped me out a lot after my husband died.
Again, I'm very sorry for your loss.
Me too, but mostly for Marco. Children need fathers.
You know, I lost my dad the same way, said Harvath.
He drowned?
He did, not too long after I graduated from high school.
I'm sorry to hear that. At least you knew him. You were lucky to have had the time that you did.
I know that now.
My father was a good man. The apple doesn't fall far from the tree.
Harvath grinned.
You don't know anything about me.
I'm very intuitive.
She was flirting with him, and he definitely felt attracted to her, but business and pleasure were often a bad mix.
I think we better order dinner, he said, raising his hand to get the waiter's attention.
They polished off a bottle of wine together, and Harvath wondered if maybe she really was trying to get him drunk when she asked if he wanted to order another one. He declined, but did say yes to some grappa. They talked about many things. How Cordero became a cop. What it was like balancing her career with being a mom. What they both did to stay in shape. How Cordero's partner had not helped him at all regarding the Four Seasons. And how Harvath had subsequently checked into the W Hotel on points. They spent the majority of their time discussing the case, and they did so in detail. Harvath admitted that even though he'd offered up Fort Hill as a likely site for the killer, it was still a long shot. He'd been trying to think outside the box. The fact was, though, that if the killer had remained in Boston, he could end up striking anywhere. For all Harvath knew, the killer was gone. He was growing more and more certain that the next time his phone rang, it would be with the news of the killer having struck in Chicago, San Francisco, or Seattle. He'd hop back on the plane, fly to wherever it had happened, and start another murder investigation from square one. It was not only frustrating, it made him angry. But there was also something else. On top of his professional reasons for not wanting to leave Boston, he also had a personal one. The more time he spent with Cordero, the more he liked being around her. It was a beautiful night and still early, so they decided to walk for a while. They passed several historic sites, like Faneuil Hall, the old corner bookstore, and the old South Meeting House, where they stopped to read their weathered bronze plaques. Harvath showed off his knowledge of Boston's role in the American Revolution and teased her good-naturedly from time to time, but she took it all in stride with a smile. By the time they reached Boston Common and his hotel, neither wanted their evening to end. He invited her in for a nightcap, but she demurred. It was already later than she had intended to be out. She joked that the one thing you could count on with children and criminals was that neither class cared how little sleep or how much to drink you'd had the night before. Both would try to turn your weakness to their advantage. He waited with her while the hotel doorman flagged a cab and then helped her climb in.
I had a very nice evening, Lara, he said. Thank you. I had a nice time, too. And it's still Detective Cordero, she replied with a mischievous grin as she closed the door and gave the driver her address.
Harvath smiled and stood back as the taxi pulled away. Her sense of humor was one of the many things that were growing on him. He stopped in the bar and ordered a cup of coffee to take up to his room. He needed to check his email, and undoubtedly, the old man, who was a night owl, would be up and would want to talk. He might even have some good news for him. At least that was what Harvath told himself as he stepped into the elevator and pressed the button for his floor. In his gut, though, he had a very bad feeling that something evil was hovering on the horizon and would make itself known sooner rather than later.
Chapter 43. Garden Court in Boston's North End was a one-way street that only allowed parking along one side. It being Boston, parking was always at a premium, and there were no spaces available. The killer hadn't expected there to be any. Pulling his van up as far as he could onto the sidewalk, he made sure there was enough space for traffic to get by, and placed a placard on his dashboard that read, "Emergency Plumbing Repair in Progress." It wouldn't stop a cop determined to give him a hard time, but he hoped not to be here long enough to draw much attention. In the meantime, the sign might prevent an angry local from calling the police because of how the van was parked. He parked as close as he could to 5 Garden Court Street in order to use the van to obscure the entrance. Stepping into the cargo area, he opened the sliding door from inside and had unfettered access to the building's front door. With his pick gun, he made quick work of the cheap lock. In the blink of an eye, the door to the empty, unoccupied ground floor apartment was open. Stepping inside, he did a quick check to make sure no squatters had taken up residence since his last reconnaissance. It was clear. He used a collapsible aluminum loading ramp to wheel the gang box out of the van and into the squalid apartment. As soon as it was in, he quickly offloaded the rest of his equipment, including the van's spare tire. The window facing the street had been covered over with newspaper, and he had no idea if the apartment even had functioning electricity. Not that it mattered. He wouldn't risk any light from inside spilling out and drawing attention. Snapping a series of glow sticks, he tossed them into corners of the tiny apartment, and then used a staple gun to hang the padded moving blanket over the inside of the window. With that complete, he focused on getting the buckets cooking. Using his knife, he pried off their lids, and with the cinder blocks and bricks, he created a series of raised platforms for each in order to get them up off the cracked linoleum floor. Next, he ignited the torches and placed them around the metal buckets in order to start heating their contents. The trick was getting them close enough to bring the ingredients to a boil without rupturing the buckets themselves and having them spill their contents all over the floor. It had taken him some practice in the days leading up to this moment to get it just right, but he had been able to perfect his technique and was confident that he could reproduce the results once he arrived in the apartment. Very soon, the air was filled with the liquid's pungent odor. He knew that it wouldn't take long to spread farther up into the 3-story building. As he had at the Liberty Tree building, he kept a silenced pistol at hand while he worked. If anyone came to investigate the source of the smell, they'd be immediately dispatched. The lion would not be deterred from his kill. He used a professional-grade infrared thermometer to monitor the temperature in each of the buckets. As they started climbing closer to their boiling points, he assembled the rolling winch system that would allow him to move each of the buckets to where he needed them without risk of spilling any of the liquid on himself. When the winch system was assembled, he rolled the spare tire into the bathroom, placed it in the tub, unscrewed the lid of a large jug, and poured the contents over it. He then placed the timing mechanism and rapidly made his way back to the living room and extinguished all the blowtorches. Unlocking the lid of the gang box, he lifted it up and looked inside. The man inside had been stripped of all his clothing, and his head had been shaved. His hands, feet, and neck were shackled to eye hooks welded to the bottom of the box. He had also been gagged. The gag was necessary, not only for quietly transporting him, but to silence the screaming he was about to do. The killer knew he was deviating from his instructions, but nevertheless, he had chosen not to administer the paralytic this time.
He wanted his victim to thrash and spasm. When they later examined the body, he wanted all involved to see the signs of the man's struggle and to envision how painful his death must have been. Making sure that the casters beneath the gang box were locked so that it would stay in place and not begin moving across the floor, he used the rolling winch system to pick up the first boiling bucket and bring it to the box. It took a moment to get it to the correct height, just above the rim of the box. But once he had it where he wanted it, he hooked two claw hammers underneath and splashed the boiling liquid inside. The naked man writhed and screamed in agony as the hot substance boiled off his flesh. Quickly, the killer fetched the next bucket and poured it in. The gang box was made of thick metal panels, which helped retain the liquid's intense heat, while its welded seams prevented even one drop from leaking. It took him exactly 8.5 more minutes to empty the remaining buckets, and then 5 more minutes to clean up and make sure he hadn't left any clues. His hair and clothing reeked, as did the rest of the apartment, but it was nothing compared to what it was going to smell like soon enough. Confident that the scene was exactly as he wanted it, he retreated outside, pulled the apartment door shut behind him, and climbed into the van. He looked at his watch and reached into his backpack for a small handheld scanner. Turning it on, he set it on the seat next to him and turned the key in the ignition. As he drove off the curb and headed away, he smiled. Sleepy Garden Court Street was about to get very, very active. Chapter 44. Washington, District of Columbia. The bald-headed CIA operative watching the house had a thick neck, broad shoulders, and meaty hands that looked like a bunch of sausages sewn together. His were not the hands of a surgeon or a pianist, but they nevertheless conducted very skilled labor. If this were not so, he never would have risen to the level he had. When he picked up the phone vibrating on the armrest next to him, it looked like a child's toy being held in a baseball mitt. He activated the call.
"Samuel speaking," he said.
"You're being retasked. Priority one," a voice said on the other end.
"Same targets?" Samuel asked, his eyes never leaving the house.
"No."
"What's my new target, please?"
"It's all in the file. You know where to find it."
"When?"
"Now," said the voice. "I'm sending someone to relieve you. They should be arriving any moment."
"Understood," Samuel replied, and disconnected the call.
Less than 10 minutes later, another black Lincoln Town Car pulled up across the street and turned off its lights. The parking lights came on momentarily before being extinguished. The relief shift had arrived. Samuel started his car, checked for traffic, and pulled away. As he did, there was a third car just up the street, whose occupants had watched the changing of the guard transpire.
"Did you see that?" McGee asked. "No, hello, Igor, how are you? How is Natasha and little Boris? No, nothing."
"That's not how these limo drivers are. They're all tight, they all come from the same part of the world, and they all clump at the same companies. That was way too fast."
Ryan agreed.
"You're right," she replied. "He wasn't here for some late-night airport run. They've got all the team members under surveillance. He was watching Tara's building to see if we'd show up."
"Or to follow her if she left," McGee said, as he looked at the clock on the dash. "It's your call. What do you want to do?"
She didn't need to think about it. She knew exactly what she wanted to do.
"Follow him."
"Roger that," he replied.
After letting two cars pass, McGee pulled into the street and began tailing the black town car. It was the only move they could make at this point, the only move that Phil Durkin wouldn't see coming. The comparison of the espionage world to chess was quite apt, except that to be the best, your mind had to be trained to see the board in all three dimensions. Of all the former teammates Ryan could have reached out to, Florentino was the most obvious. They had not only anticipated that she would do it, they had been ready for her. Hindsight was always 20/20, and she and McGee both now realized what a mistake it had been. For his part, though, McGee didn't seem to have fully learned the lesson. He wanted to go after another team member, this time being more careful, As far as Ryan was concerned, being more careful was not a clever enough plan. They needed to be more cunning. There was no use trying to grab another gazelle from the back of the herd if there was a predator hiding in the bushes waiting to spring once you made your move. Ryan's plan was to wait until the predator had left the safety of the bushes and then spring her own trap. Was the man driving the town car their predator? She couldn't be 100% sure yet, but her gut told her that they were right on the money, and her gut was seldom, if ever, wrong. As they followed him, the driver conducted multiple SDRs to ascertain if he had anyone on his tail.
"This guy appears to have had a little bit of training," said McGee.
"Which means we were right to follow him," Ryan replied. "Whatever you do, don't lose him."
They came close to doing just that 3 times. The driver of the town car was good, but McGee and Ryan were better. He led them to a neighborhood alive with nightlife in the northwest part of the city known as Adams Morgan. After circling the block, he parked illegally on 18th Street near a 24-hour restaurant called The Diner and left his vehicle with its flashers on.
"What's he up to now?"
McGee asked, as he eased the Mustang into a no-parking zone at the end of the block.
"He can't be here for the coffee."
Ryan turned in her seat and watched out the rear window.
"Why not?"
"Because I've eaten here before. The coffee's good, but it's not worth driving halfway across town and risking a parking ticket over."
By her count, they had passed at least 3 places where the driver could have gotten coffee and been able to legally park.
"Maybe he's getting something to eat."
"Maybe. Or maybe there's another reason he left his surveillance post and had to hightail it over here."
A few minutes later, the man re-emerged with a styrofoam cup and climbed back into his town car.
"I call bullshit," said McGee.
"You can call it whatever you want," Ryan stated, as she continued to watch him. "But get ready, because he's going to pull a U-turn."
"Where's he going now?"
he asked, as he checked the approaching traffic and tried to figure out how he was going to execute the same maneuver without the driver of the town car seeing him.
"I don't know, but something tells me he didn't know until he went into that diner."
Samuel placed his hot tea in a cup holder before gauging the traffic and executing his U-turn. No sooner had he done so than his cell phone rang.
"Samuel speaking," he said after activating the call.
"You retrieved the envelope?"
the voice on the other side asked.
"I did."
"You read the contents?"
"I did." "I understand there are personal reasons why this assignment could be problematic," the voice said. "But you are not going to allow any personal reasons to make this assignment problematic. Is that correct?"
"That is correct," replied Samuel. He had removed the envelope from its hiding place in the bathroom, read, and then memorized its contents. All of it was printed on water-soluble paper, which he destroyed by dropping it in a toilet and flushing. The target was indeed known to him. They had a history together. But that history would not stop him from carrying out his assignment. His job was to act, not to ask questions. This would be like any other assignment. A job was just that, a job. Once the call was finished, he placed his cell phone down on the seat and picked back up his tea. Peeling back the plastic lid, he blew into the cup and gauged the temperature by how much steam rose from the surface. It was much too hot to drink now, but by the time he got to Bill Wise's house, it should be just about perfect. Chapter 45. Samuel did an inconspicuous drive-by of Bill Wise's property. It was an older building that appeared to have been a warehouse at some point. This was both good and bad. It was good in that Wise didn't have neighbors right on top of him that would see or hear things, but it was bad in that commercial buildings presented their own special challenges for surreptitious entry. Whenever possible, Samuel liked to surveil his own targets. Tonight, though, this wasn't possible. The job needed to be taken care of right away. The building had a front entrance, a side roll-up garage door, and an alley entrance. The alley looked like it was going to be his best bet. Getting in wouldn't be a problem, as long as Wise cooperated. Samuel noted that Wise had a security system. That was going to need to be turned off. He felt confident he could get the man to do that for him. With a plan beginning to form in his mind, he set off in search of the items he would need to accomplish his mission. 45 minutes later, everything was ready to launch. When the weather was nice, Bill Wise liked to sleep with his skylights vented. Staggered sensors were one of the easiest and smartest inventions alarm companies had ever come up with. The breeze was free to come in, but if anyone tried to raise the skylight beyond where it was right now, the alarm immediately sounded. Living in the city, he'd learned to sleep through a lot. Helicopters, emergency vehicles, rap music thumping out of passing cars, none of it bothered him. He knew physiologically that all of those sound waves were penetrating his ear canals. For its part, his brain didn't process any of those things as a threat, and therefore allowed him to continue sleeping. The sound of a breaking bottle right outside, though, was something different. While you could walk down any street on any given day and see shards of broken glass, it was rare for most people to ever hear bottles being broken. That sound normally meant alcohol had been consumed in excess. It also meant that violence to persons or property might be imminent. Wise's brain passed along the message. Bottle broken. Outside. Close. He went from being fully asleep to fully awake in a fraction of a second. As he lay in bed, eyes open, he wasn't waiting for confirmation. He knew what he had heard. He was attempting to gather additional information. Had the bottle been thrown out of a car? Had it come from the front of the building or in the alley? Had the person or persons moved on? Almost instantly, he had his answer, as another bottle broke and voices were raised. There was at least one adult male in front, and he was arguing with someone else. Once the neighborhood was fully gentrified and real estate prices went even higher, Wise was going to make a fortune from selling his property. Until then, he had to put up with crap like this. Grabbing the remote, he flipped on his TV and clicked over to his security camera feeds. He was greeted by the sight of two local crackheads, one male and one female, engaged in urban couples counseling only a few feet in front of his building. He watched as the woman reached into the plastic bag at her feet, pulled out a third bottle, and launched it at the man. As it sailed past its intended target and shattered against the front door, Wise had had enough. It was time for the crackheads to pack it in and move their party someplace else. He quickly pulled on jeans and a t-shirt and slipped his large feet into a pair of boots. After tucking the Beretta from the nightstand in his waistband, he grabbed his Surefire flashlight and headed for the front door. From a closet off the reception area, he retrieved an aluminum baseball bat and deactivated the alarm system. He left the lights off so as not to silhouette himself when he opened the front door. By the time he got it unlocked, two more bottles had smashed against the front of the building, and Bill Wise was fit to be tied.
"What the fuck's wrong with you?"
he roared, as he threw the door open and stepped outside.
"This ain't none of your damn business,"
the woman yelled as she fished in her bag for another bottle.
"Like hell it isn't. There's broken glass all over my fucking property."
"She's crazy, man,"
the male crackhead replied, as he tried to hide behind Wise.
"Whoa, whoa, whoa,"
Wise replied, extending the bat like a traffic control arm at a border crossing.
"You stay right in front of me where I can keep my eye on you."
"You don't want to mind your own business?"
the woman challenged.
"Then you're gonna get some pain, too."
Wise thought about pulling his Beretta, but instead whipped out his Surefire and aimed the bright beam in the woman's eyes.
"Put that bottle down right now," he ordered.
"Fuck you!
Put it down, or you're both going to jail. Do it, now."
"You heard the man,"
the male crackhead said.
"Put that damn bottle down."
"You zip it," Wise commanded. "I'm the one giving orders."
"Whatever you say."
"Last chance," Wise said to the woman. "Put the bottle down right now."
Slowly, the woman lowered the bottle and set it on the ground. Wise released the tail cap switch on his flashlight and the beam extinguished.
"Man, I can't see shit now. I'd sue your ass for giving me blindness," she spat.
Yeah, I gave you blindness, Wise replied. And the next thing I'm going to give you is a taste of old school. I'm getting a broom and a dustpan, and then you two are going to sweep up all of this glass.
I ain't sweeping up shit.
You bet your ass you're sweeping, honey, Wise replied. If you don't, I'm having you two arrested. I know you live in the neighborhood, and I'm guessing several of my cop friends know who you are. The choice is up to you.
The woman relented. She exhaled a drawn-out and dejected, shit. Wise shook his head. Careful not to turn his back on the pair, he retreated inside for a broom, a dustpan, and a small garbage can. Stepping outside, he half expected them to be gone, but they were still there, and had even begun to argue again.
Pipe down, he barked. You two lovebirds can coo all you want once this is all cleaned up, and you've flown off someplace else.
As they were going to be cleaning up around his entrance, the last thing Wise wanted was for them to be able to have a clear look inside. Not that his foyer area was all that fancy, but the less these two pillars of the community knew about his domicile, the better, and so he closed the door behind him. Wise stood on the sidewalk and watched. It was pathetic. You'd have thought neither had ever handled a broom or a dustpan before. They were completely useless. He let it go on for about 5 minutes before finally throwing in the towel. They were so drug or alcohol-addled that they could barely stand up straight, much less bend over to sweep and pick up broken glass. At some point, one of them was going to get hurt, and that wasn't something he wanted.
That's enough, he said, taking the broom and dustpan away from them. Go on. Get out of here. Get lost.
Wise watched as they looked at each other, then looked at him, and began to walk away. The woman stopped to pick up her plastic bag, until Wise shook his head and clucked his tongue. It was bad enough they had woken him up. The least he could do was make sure they didn't roust anyone else in the neighborhood.
The one-man community watch strikes again.
He half laughed and sighed as he picked up the woman's bag, dropped it in the trash can, and then made quick work of the broken glass. He had no idea whether being forced to clean up some of the mess would have any impact on the pair. It likely wouldn't, but Wise felt he had done the right thing. Too many people didn't stand up for what was right anymore. Picking up the trash can, he stepped back inside and set it down along with the broom, the bat, and the dustpan. He sensed the man's presence just before the figure stepped from the darkness, and with his gun pointed right at him said,
"Good evening, Dr. Wise."
Wise knew better than to go for his Beretta. He'd be dead before he could pull it from his waistband. Instead, he calmly and politely replied,
"It's good to see you again, Samuel."
Chapter 46.
"All the way down to my shorts? Seriously?" Wise asked,
after he had carefully, albeit reluctantly, already surrendered his firearm, as well as his flashlight.
"Please see it as a token of my respect," Samuel replied,
as he stood still, partially concealed and a safe distance away.
"If you intend to show me proper respect, Samuel, why don't you tell me why you're here?"
"We'll have plenty of time to talk, Dr. Wise. Right now, I'd appreciate your cooperation."
Wise did as his captor asked. After removing his boots, jeans, and t-shirt, he did a 360-degree turn for Samuel with his hands above his head. The hitman then had him face away from him, sweep his arms behind him like a sandpiper with his palms up. Samuel told him to look up at the ceiling as he bent over at the waist. He instructed him to spread his legs so far apart that Wise was forced up on the balls of his feet and having trouble keeping his balance. That was when Samuel struck. The first handcuff was on him so fast and was converted into a steel wrist lock so quickly that even if Wise had wanted to react, he couldn't have. The pain was exquisite. Samuel delivered so much precise and practiced pressure that Wise's knees simply buckled and he dropped to the ground. Even the most veteran of street cops would have been blown away with how rapidly Samuel had subdued his prisoner and applied the handcuffs. Wise was told which knee to bend, and then on the count of three, used momentum to bring him back up to standing. An amateur would have simply grabbed him by the chain of the cuffs and lifted, risking tearing the prisoner's shoulders out. Samuel was no amateur. He took great care in guiding Wise back to the building's living area. He knew all too well that a man like Wise would have all sorts of weapons hidden all around. Near the machinist's bay, where Wise worked on his cars and motorcycles, Samuel had placed a chair. He asked Wise to sit there now. Wise complied.
"Now we talk?"
Samuel nodded.
"Yes, doctor. Now we talk."
"I assume that you have a list of specific questions you would like answered."
"I do."
Wise pursed his lips.
"And what will I get in return?"
"Out of respect and professional courtesy," he said, unrolling a suede tool bag with multiple stainless steel instruments and a handful of zip ties that had been rubber banded together.
"I will not cause you any pain."
"Well, that's very thoughtful, Samuel. Pain is something neither of us likes, is it?"
"No, doctor, it is not."
"Will I be free to go afterward?"
Wise asked. The CIA operative shook his head as he pulled the rubber band from around the zip ties.
"I'm sorry."
"So am I."
Samuel stepped forward, and in a move that belied his thick, lumbering appearance, grabbed a handful of Wise's hair and snapped his head backward, banging it against the back of the chair. It was a move meant to stun and disorient, which was exactly what it did. Before Wise knew what had happened, Samuel had attached his handcuffs to the chair with several of the zip ties. His legs would be next. Samuel came around front and looked at Wise. The man's eyelids fluttered like a pair of shades that had just been drawn too tight, and his head lolled to one side. Grabbing his left ankle, he slammed it up against the left leg of the chair and had just gotten the first zip tie halfway around both when a shot rang out and piercing and painful darkness overtook him. For a moment, he had no idea what had happened. Then, the excruciating pain came rushing in, and he realized that Wise had headbutted him. Then, still cuffed to the chair, he had run. Samuel reached up and touched the bridge of his nose. It was broken and bleeding.
"I understand why you had to do that, Dr. Wise," he called out as he stood and pulled his pistol. "I even forgive you for it, as I hope you will forgive me for what I have to do."
The CIA operative looked around as his mind whirled through multiple calculations. It was a large space, but not so large that a man Wise's size could disappear, especially not when attached to a chair. He would try to find concealment first, and then he would avail himself of a weapon. That was, of course, only if he could free his hands. Samuel settled on Wise's library and its rows of metal bookcases. They provided the closest and most logical place to hide. He approached the stacks with caution, pausing every couple of steps to listen. All he needed was the squeak of the chair beneath Wise's weight or the scrape of its legs on the floor to give the man away. Step, step, pause. Step, step, pause. Suddenly, he heard something else. At the end of the next aisle, a book had been knocked from its place and lay on the floor. He had him now. Samuel rushed along the row of books, and no sooner had he made it to the halfway point than he heard the groan of metal on metal, and a wall of books began to rain down on him. Wise was trying to tip the bookcase over from the other side and crush him. The bald-headed man ran for all he was worth as the tidal wave of books poured over him. With the case only centimeters from his head, he dove to get out of the way. He landed hard, his chin slamming into the ground and his pistol clattering out of his hand. He saw stars once more, but he also saw something else. Wise. The man was doing everything he could to break the chair and free himself. Their eyes locked, and then both men's gaze snapped to the gun. Wise was closer. And though he was still attached to the chair, it had splintered and he was close to being free. Samuel pushed himself up to standing and put his head down, his shoulder forward, and ran for all he was worth. This wasn't about getting to the gun first. This was about stopping Wise from getting to it at all. The CIA operative built up such an amazing head of steam that when he collided with Wise, it was like a locomotive hitting a fruit truck stalled at the crossing. As the thick-necked bull of a man barreled into him, Wise's chair shattered, and he was sent tumbling backward. His head cracked against the floor, and his vision dimmed. The pain was off the charts, and he teetered on the verge of unconsciousness. He couldn't allow himself to slip into that dark, cold void. He had to fight. He wouldn't get another chance. Flipping onto his left side, he planned to lash out with a kick, either to push the gun farther away or to incapacitate his attacker. As he looked up, though, he saw he was too late. Samuel had already retrieved the weapon. He had also wisely taken two steps back once he was able to stand. He was too far away for Wise to make contact. He had had one chance, and he had blown it. Samuel was back in control. Neither man spoke. Both stood or lay where they were catching their breaths and trying to overcome the pain of their injuries. Wise could see that he had opened up a pretty good gash at the top of Samuel's nose. It was going to require stitches. At least there was that. Out of habit, Wise started analyzing his own injuries and then almost laughed at the absurdity of it all. He wasn't going to live to see another hour, much less anyone who could give him medical attention. Samuel, who must have sensed something in his expression, said, "What's so funny?" Just then, a man stepped from behind Samuel.